Now a fly ball deep to left off the bat of Schmidt, and this one is out of here, and this game is completely blown away. A three-run homer for Casey Schmidt, his sixth home run of the year, and the Giants now lead it 12-2.
All right, welcome back to the Just Mets podcast, a subscription podcast for diehard Mets fans. I'm your host, Rich McLeod, and if you were hoping this team was going to build off their seven-game winning streak, unfortunately, I have bad news for you. The inconsistency continues. Here to talk to me about the continued adventures of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Met is a senior MLB writer from The Athletic, Will Salmon. Will, how you doing, man?
Good. Good to be on with you, Rich.
Good for you as well. So I want to ask, you know, the Mets go 1-5 over this past week, but it, you know, kind of is more of a continuation of what we've been seeing since about the middle of June. They get swept by the Padres. They lose 2 of 3 to the Giants, a team who just actually sold to the Mets. Offense was a bit up and down. You know, they had a great game on Saturday, but the other games pretty poor. The pitching has been really a big issue. And, you know, they're kind of like going back and forth with the Phillies in first place. What is your level of concern with this team right now?
Not as high as it may be for some fans who watch this team and are very disgruntled about the inconsistencies across the board, only because I look at it and they're still, what, more than 10 games over 500. They're still, as we're sitting here talking, tied for first place in the NL East, though that could change. Point is, they remain in a fairly solid spot. It's not as if it's crumbling beneath them by any means. However, it's an inconsistent team as of late. And even going back further, I shouldn't even say as of late, it's been a while since they've gotten to a level of steady winning. I know you mentioned the winning streak before. That almost felt like an anomaly of sorts,
yeah,
based on like what we've seen the last couple of months. But they still did it. They still were able to pull it off nonetheless. But I do have some concerns with just what they're getting or not getting from their starting rotation. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they have not hit this season the way that we thought this lineup would and that this lineup is probably capable of. We have yet to see it for any stretch of meaningful time, it feels like. And their first four guys in the batting order hold all the importance for this team. And when they're not going well, this team is not winning. And when they do perform well, their chances of winning goes way up. So it falls on those guys, as it should. They're the highest paid players on the team. They're the best players on the team. But there's definitely some flaws here, like as far as like what this roster is comprised of and where they thought they may get production and where they're not. And all that said, though, they remain in a fairly solid spot.
Yeah, it's, you know, to speak to what you were mentioning about, you know, it hasn't just been like a recent skid of inconsistencies, you know, going back to June 13th, that's a kind of like the infamous date of demarcation at this point when that series against the Rays started. The Mets are 18-25, which is the fifth worst record in baseball, worse than the Braves and the White Sox in that time. Their offense is averaging 4 runs a game, also fifth worst. Starting pitchers have a 5.43 ERA, which is the fourth worst. And then their bullpen as well, 5.15 ERA, fifth worst. So pretty evenly split of like there isn't even just one issue. I think fans and people in the media even like to like debate which is the bigger problem. Is it the starters? Is it the offense? Is it the relievers? It really has kind of been a team-wide problem for this last, you know, month and a half, getting close to 2 months. Is there anything that you think happened that led to this, or was this team just maybe playing above their heads for the first couple months, and this is just like the realities of baseball always seeming to even itself out, just in this case doing it kind of in a bit of an epic way?
Some of that's probably right, where they I hope for the Mets fans' sake they didn't peak early, but maybe they did. You know, maybe that's the case, and maybe they played their best baseball early on this year. Could happen that way. I don't necessarily think it is lining up that way. Maybe it just is the fact that there are some ebbs and flows. There was going to be some regression after mm-hmm. that hot start, both on an individual level for some of these guys and on a team level. And we saw that. And then there was always going to be some of, hey, this is a struggle portion of the season type of thing. Again, like, I don't know if my concern level is like super high right now. It's more so, yeah, there are concerns and we could point them out. But they're at that spot where I think we're going to know just what kind of contender they are over this next stretch of games, like over this next period, because now we've seen them at their best, we've seen them at their worst, and then we've now seen a little bit of a middle ground. And so these final weeks, particularly as we get to those games against the Phillies, obviously, that's going to set the tone for what we should expect. Like, is this a team that just barely gets into the playoffs as one of the wildcard teams, or is this a team that starts to regain some focus and wins the division? And that's what their focus should be on. That's what the goal should be, is to win that division for a change. Yeah. I think they're capable of it still. It's just, it has not been clicking for a variety of reasons. I don't know if it's like one thing, like you said, like your question said, because it's been a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And for a while, the one thing I would have pointed to was the bullpen, for instance, but that got fixed at the trade deadline. And that's no longer the weakness. It's actually the strength. And they're still losing. Like, they came out of the trade deadline losing 2 out of 3. And it really had nothing to do with the bullpen. It was their inability versus left-handed pitching to muster any offense, mm-hmm. and their lack of quality from their rotation in some regards there. So it's hard to really drill down on, like, hey, this is the one reason why they're losing or why we have not seen them turn things up. But I will say that, like, this is a pretty good team, I still think.
They fixed the bullpen at the deadline. They get 3 new arms in here. And I think, you know, 2 really high quality guys. And then Soto, I think, even really helps that bullpen out, because now they have 2 quality lefties there. And look, when they get into October, assuming they do make the playoffs, it is going to be a huge factor. But you have to get these games to the bullpen. And to your point, you know, on Sunday especially, they weren't able to do that. And even on Friday, I think, even though that game did go into extra innings, that game was really on the offense for, once again, you know, lacking a big hit. They, over this past week, they go 11 for 42 with runners in scoring position, which for them is actually really good. That's .262. The issue with that is 8 of those 11 hits came on Saturday. So it's a bit misleading in that way. So in their other games this past week, still has reigned a struggle for that. Well, you're around this team every single day and you've been there for this entire stretch of poor play. Has the vibe for the team at any point changed, or have they been pretty, like, consistently confident this entire time?
Yeah, it's been pretty much the same. I haven't really seen any sort of significant change within personalities and how they conduct themselves. I think that kind of starts for the Mets with Lindor, and he sort of sets a tone of sort of being the same type of personality every single day these days, where you could catch him after a poor stretch of games and you really wouldn't know it that he was struggling so much through your conversation with him. Mm-hmm. Not to say he doesn't care or anything like that. That's not what I'm saying. But it's just the fact that he just conducts himself pretty consistent. And I think he gives that consistent presence to the clubhouse, and it bleeds over to the other guys in there. And I think Pete Alonso is similar in that way. Brendan Nimmo is similar in that way. So it's not just Lindor, but I'd say it starts with him. And it trickles down to the rest of the guys. So, no, not really. Like, it has not really been that way. I think that they've remained pretty confident in themselves. And I think that they've been pretty consistent with just how they've approached every single day, even after losses or even after a losing streak.
Yeah. And, you know, you brought up the trade deadline. You know, the Mets do a lot with the bullpen, but the other aspects of the team that have been struggling, you know, they didn't address too much. They do bring in Cedric Mullins, which is, I'd say, like, a more of a floor raising type move for the offense. They now have kind of like a league average hitter in center field versus what they were getting before, which was that split between McNeil, who maybe wasn't the best center fielder, but was a good hitter, and Taylor, who's a great defender, but really, really struggled offensively when he was being asked to play all the time this year. But with the starting rotation, you know, you wrote an article right after the trade deadline about, like, why the Mets didn't go for a starting pitcher. A lot of it had to do with the price was maybe too high. A lot of guys were not moved that we thought would be. Joe Ryan, Mitch Keller, Alcantara, even Dylan Cease, all these guys stay put. Can you just expand a little bit more on just you know, why didn't the Mets get a starting pitcher, and were they in talks to at least get one, and it was just, you know, the asking prices were just simply too high?
Well, they checked in on some guys, as teams do. I think once you get a feel for what it's going to cost you and you put that into the equation of how important it is for a particular club, it did not check out. We saw that throughout the league. Even teams that were in more of a need, you would argue, for starting pitching than the Mets, didn't land one, or didn't land one of major significance. The best starter that got moved was Merrill Kelly,
right,
who is a rental, who's having a nice season. I think I look at him as a playoff starter because of the season that he's having, but his career numbers do not line up with what you think of for an ace. So that was the best guy who got moved. There were other starting pitchers who got traded, like a Shane Bieber, who has yet to pitch this season, and Dustin May, who has been ineffective this season. So like, there are other examples of it, but none of those guys are number ones or number twos or even really number threes, except for Kelly. So it was a weird market in that sense. I think we saw a lot of teams pivot to bullpen help and view that as the path to winning a World Series based on what previous World Series runs have taught us, where you could ride that bullpen all the way through and it will be okay, and it will be something that's dominant. So a lot of teams saw that and did that. There were a lot of relievers out there to do that and to make that kind of move. So I think that was part of it. And it didn't, for the Mets' sake, it allowed you to not take from the top of your farm system to do that. Other teams, it was a little bit different. They did have to sacrifice, but for the Mets, they did not necessarily have to sacrifice from the top to get that accomplished. So I think that was part of it. And also just, I think that they did like what they had in their starting rotation heading into the trade deadline, where they thought, okay, Senga, Minaya, these are our top two guys, along with David Peterson, who's been doing it all season. But Senga and Minaya are very important for us, and we feel like eventually we'll get to a point pretty soon where we can count on those guys for length in addition to David Peterson, and it won't be as bad as it looks, because they didn't necessarily sign Clay Holmes to pitch six, seven innings, not at this point in the season anyway. And then Frankie Montas is definitely looking like your fifth starter. So, you know, I could see it from their perspective. Would I have thought that they should have gotten another starter? Generally speaking, yeah. But in this particular market, I can't really fault them for not doing it, because nobody else was able to do it either. And the price of it was just extremely high. For Alcantara, I had heard at least two top five guys in the farm system plus something else. So you're talking a lot. Like, that's a pretty significant haul. And when prices are that high, it usually is an indicator that the teams don't really want to part with those guys in the first place. So that's valid that's valuable information. And then in other cases where we're talking about a Merrill Kelly, Mitch Keller for the Pittsburgh Pirates or guys like that, I never really heard the Mets being involved in any of those guys. I know, like, maybe it was out there in reports. I don't see that happening. I never saw that as a serious pursuit. So they went into the deadline having a good feel for what the market would look like, as far as my reporting led me to believe. And it looked like that was what happened. Like, there weren't a whole lot of starters out there that were available, evidently. And only a couple of them got moved in the end anyway. So I think they made the best of the situation. So, yeah, in a vacuum, sure. Should they have gotten a starter? Yeah. But that just was not what was available right now.
Yeah, it is. It's always tough, right, to be like, you know, especially for fans. You get upset, you get frustrated about, like, oh, but, like, why didn't they get this guy? Why didn't they get that guy? But it is sometimes hard to be upset about not getting guys who didn't get moved at all. You know, it's one thing if, you know, Joe Ryan went to the Red Sox or something, you're like, oh, why weren't the Mets in on that? But he didn't get moved. Alcantara didn't get moved, to your point. And it is a tougher thing to kind of, you know, evaluate, and, you know, it just might not have been the year for that. And for the Mets, I think that goes back more than, it's, you know, even less than what didn't they do at the deadline, because what was available was what was available. It kind of goes back to the off season of, like, okay, if you have this rotation where you have Sean Manaea coming back, has an injury history. Kodai Senga has an injury history. Oftentimes, you know, is 5-6 innings, even at his best. Then you bring in a older reliever trying to become a starter for the first time. And then Frankie Montas, who has struggled for several seasons now and also has a lot of injury histories and doesn't really go deep into games either. You almost kind of go back to the original sin of the offseason. And it was like, was that the mistake? Like, you could make the merits of each of the pitchers on their own, but when you're putting them into one starting rotation that has to gel together, you're all of a sudden, other than David Peterson, you don't really have a lot of guys who are known for staying healthy or getting deep into games, and then Holmes being the ultimate wild card. Do you look back on that and think maybe they should have approached things differently in the offseason, especially because there weren't that many options for them to pivot at the deadline?
It's a fair question to ask, for sure. I think so. The way that they saw it was, the way that their starting rotation is going to get better in the long run in the future is if they develop guys, whether that's going to be someone like Christian Scott when he's healthy, Brendan Sproat, Nolan McLean, Jonah Tong even. These are the guys that they're counting on to be those guys. Like, we've seen a reluctance from David Stearns' front office to go after the Corbin Burns of the world, where you're shelling out 5-6 years, maybe four in some cases, for these top of the line pitchers. And there's reasons for that. And we saw it play out, unfortunately, in the case of Corbin Burns, where he got hurt and now he's out for the season, and that contract doesn't look as good anymore. So like, you can go back and forth with it and look at it both ways. So it is tough. So the Mets in their instance, they said, we're going to focus on developing our younger guys, and like, when they're ready a couple of years from now or whenever it is, our rotation will be in a better state of mind, I think, a better state of the rotation. And what they do in the short run, in the short term, is they focus on guys who could come in for a 1-year deal, a 2-year deal, whatever it is, pitch well and go on their way, sort of thing. And it worked last year with Sean Manaea and Luis Severino. So clearly they know what they're doing in that regard, and they deserve some credit. This year, in the case of Frankie Montas, it has not worked out. That looks like a very curious decision to give him 2 years. It's one of the rare moves, I would say, that has not panned out for David Stearns and his front office over these first 2 years. So it definitely is fair to question, like, what was the right path there? Like, should they have gone, especially when you look at adding Juan Soto and the nucleus of talent, the core group that they have, should they have gone after an ace? Yeah, I could see the argument for it for sure. I do think it sounds that they did not in some ways because of their rationale, but you could definitely make the case of it. Absolutely. And even looking at this trade deadline and what they didn't do in the starting rotation, I will add that Sproat and McLean and the ability to move those guys up to the majors fairly soon if needed or when needed, that factored into it as well, as in regards to not targeting a number four starter or, you know, a floor type number three guy, is because they believe that if they need that, they have that AAA that they could rely on, or they could at least plug in and try. That said, neither of those guys have pitched in the major leagues, so we don't really know how good they're going to be when they come up here. We have yet to see them in the major leagues even. So I think personally you're asking a lot from those guys to come up in August or September and to be a factor. But David Stearns has done it in the past with the Brewers, where he did pull that off with Corbin Burns and Brandon Woodruff and Freddie Peralta. So we'll see. But it's definitely a fair question to raise, Rich.
Yeah. You know, it's definitely not fair to say this, because I think David Stearns and the pitching lab, even this early into their time here, have earned a lot of benefit of the doubt and respect, like what they did last year. And in some aspects, what they've done this year has been impressive too. Like, the Griffin Canning thing was just horrible luck for them. Like, he was awesome, way better than he had any right to be considering his career numbers. But there's part of me that even felt at the moment like the Montas signing was almost like a heat check in basketball, where you're just like, I'm feeling good, we're shooting well, like, let's go for it. And it hasn't worked out. And I think you asked Carlos Mendoza after the game today, you know, if he was, you know, if there's a discussion for maybe Montas' role changing and coming out of the rotation. And you know, Mendoza's never going to give you a straight answer like that, but it was as non-committal, I think, as Carlos gets, which I felt was really interesting. And I think the connection to the young pitchers that you bring up is the biggest thing there. You know, they said in the offseason, they said it at the deadline, you know, we don't want to trade these guys because we want to use them. We don't want to spend a bunch of assets on these starting pitchers because these guys can fill that role. But like you said, we haven't seen them. What are they waiting for at this point, especially with Nolan McLain? I think Sproat is probably a tick behind him in terms of development, and Tong is not a discussion for this year. I don't think that's fair at all. But at what point are we going to see Nolan McLain, and why do you think it hasn't happened yet?
A couple of things come to mind. I think also what I should have added to my answer to your previous question about why they didn't go in that ace aisle and if that was fair to criticize. Now, they did target a lot of depth, I will say that, right? They made that a priority for starting pitching. They added Griffin Canning, like you mentioned. They knew that they had Paul Blackburn. They knew they had Tyler McGill. They didn't know that they were going to have to rely on all those guys in the beginning of the season the way that they did. Those were supposed to be your 6, 7, 8 guys and beyond. And so Sproat played Tidwell, even, who got traded, and Nolan McLain. That was the next wave of guys. Anyway,
9, 10, 11.
Right. So, like, they were in a fairly solid place for a little while there. But now we're at the point where, I don't know, it's hard to a couple of things with those two guys in particular, because there's the discussion of should they just piggyback and be relievers and be like a 3-4 inning option after, say, Clay Holmes or Frankie Montas. And they could have done that maybe like last month when things were falling apart a little bit. But I believe David Stearns has made this point. Other executives make this point all the time. When you're talking about that, once you do that, it's a little bit irreversible at that point in the season where you're not going to then make them a starting pitcher again. Like, it's already kind of late to be playing around with that. So you have to be pretty committed to that. And you have to know that that's the lane that you're going to be in the rest of the season. So I don't know if that's going to – I can't really criticize that part of it. But I don't know. I may have liked to have seen McLain earlier in the year, maybe last month or so, get one of those spot starts that went to somebody else when they used an opener. There are 40-man roster things that they have to think about when, okay, if we put this guy on the 40-man right now, does that stop us from doing something in the future? Because now – even if he may not even pitch again this month, he has to remain on the 40-man roster for us. So that's a serious consideration that they have to make. And it's tough to do that before the trade deadline and before you know exactly how many guys you're bringing onto your roster and how many spots you need. So I get all of that. Where we're at right now, I don't really know if there's anything that's stopping it, really, Rich, between like why they haven't done it, like say why they won't do it this week, for instance.
Right.
I feel like there's a need there. I feel like they present an option that's of intrigue that you should find out at this point whether or not they're ready for this, because Nolan McLain, you could maybe nitpick at his numbers versus left-handed batters or whatever it is. My counter to that would be, name me the starting pitchers that have been perfect out of AAA that have been 100% ready and that just completely took off. Like, it's just not going to be perfect when you bring them up, unfortunately. And they're going to run into some struggles in the major leagues anyway. So I feel like there's a good argument to make to get a look at those guys now. And even in the case of Brandon Sproat, he has never really pitched better than this. So, like, when you assess the level that he's at in AAA, I know he had great numbers last year at the lower levels, but now we're talking about AAA. Why not capitalize on what he's doing? He's clearly on a roll. So I don't know which one of those guys they would call on first, actually, but I do know that both of them are pretty much ready at this point. I just don't really see the downside at this particular point. I know they may wait, and they may even wait to September when the rosters expand by 2. I just feel like it's just too late almost, because by then games are going to only matter more, it looks like, and you're asking a lot to bring up somebody from AAA who has never done it before. So I would argue to get the look at the guy now, see some of what you have there, and who knows, maybe that's something that also creates some momentum for you guys, and we've seen it before where a top prospect comes up and all of a sudden injects a little bit of energy at the right time. I think those things are real, actually. I think that those things actually do matter in some instances, and this could be one.
Yeah, I mean, look at the 2015 Mets. Half of that rotation was rookies. They called Conforto up straight up from Double A that year. That helped with the lineup. You know, there's definitely precedent for it. And, you know, you bring up like, yeah, you can nitpick anything for these guys. And obviously the Mets want to protect them. You know, they're not going to throw these guys to the wolves if they don't think that they're ready. Like I've been saying for weeks, you can kind of tell how David Stearns feels about Blade Tidwell because he doesn't mind jockeying him around between the Triple A and the major leagues. He's not going to do that with guys that he actually thinks are going to be really good. But this rotation is kind of bleeding at this point. And, you know, how's Frankie Montas doing against any handed hitter at this point? You know, you don't want to go into September because these games they all mean the same. It feels like they mean more in September, but do you really want to be in the middle of September and be like, wow, we wasted like 15 games throughout the season because we were throwing Justin Hageman out there and Huascar Brazoban was starting games and all these, you know, Frankie Montas now. You don't want to be giving so many games away because that stuff catches up to you at the end. And I don't think they're in a position right now to be punting games. And, you know, by starting a guy they gave a 2-year deal to, I'm sure they don't see it as that, but the results are the results. And I do think there needs to be a little bit more urgency from the way that they're managing this starting staff.
Yeah, I think that you can make the case that for Frankie Montas, maybe it's time for him to work on things outside of the rotation. If you do believe in him too, also, like, it looks like it's not getting corrected start to start. If you love his stuff as much as the Mets claim that they do, and evidently they do, they awarded the man a 2-year deal. So right. They clearly like the stuff. It's there. But there's a disconnect between the stuff and the results and the stuff when it's time to play the game. Like, that's just not working out. So, yeah, you could definitely make the case for that and to push the button for one of those other guys. And again, like, to your point about just the idea of not yo-yoing a guy back and forth from AAA to the majors, yeah, you know, that's definitely was a consideration probably as well for a guy like Sprode or clearly McClain when he was rolling earlier in the year. And there's also those 40-man roster considerations where they don't necessarily need to have those guys on the 40-man. So that played into it, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. But at this point in the season, when it's August, and as you put it, the rotation is bleeding a bit, and you have that spot, that should be a discussion in my view. Why not? Why not try it?
Yeah. You brought it up. It actually is an interesting point. You know, let's say they do call up one of these guys this week, whichever one, it doesn't matter. What do you think they would actually do with Montas? Would they put him in the bullpen and, you know, maybe option or release somebody else? Ryan Stanek obviously is probably not super safe on the roster. Or do you think that David Stearns would actually consider cutting him and just before even the first season of his contract is over, moving on? That seems a little aggressive for him, even with Cohen's blessing. But is that even possible?
Yeah, I don't think it's that dire for Frankie Montas. I don't, because like you're talking about a guy who they believed in enough to give him 2 years. So he's only had 7 starts under his belt for this year. He missed half the season. So I think that there's definitely the leeway of like, hey, we view this guy as some sort of part of our roster. I'm saying that for whatever reason, things are not working out from the preparation and the stuff that everybody likes to the game. Like, it's just not translating. So maybe mm-hmm. there needs to be some time to get that to a level of like, okay, we know it's going to translate because we fixed X, Y, and Z about this equation. That may require time from what it looks like for me. So I don't really know what that looks like, if that's him going to the bullpen for a while or something else. It's hard to do that with this roster because of the way it's comprised of one inning leverage relievers. Like, there's a bunch of guys, and it's like a playoff roster at this point where you have all these big time relievers. You don't have a long reliever. You don't have a mop up guy in a traditional way. you're sort of doing a shuttle between that one spot that you had that Rico Garcia was hanging on to after the trade deadline. So you DFA'd him, brought in Austin Warren, who threw four innings. I would imagine that they want that spot to go to somebody else because Warren can't pitch for a few days now. So
right.
I would expect somebody else would come up and claim it. But outside of that spot, there's really no other leeway. Like, you're not going to option Reed Garrett, who's been very effective for you, and he's the only reliever who has options of that group. And that leaves you with the decision point, like you said, on speculating on Stanek. He is the one guy that has not pitched consistently enough well for a little while now. And his ERA, I think, is creeping up around 5 for the season.
I went above it today.
So I'm not sure. I'm not, but that would be – there's only a couple of paths for this team to take if they want to go that route of calling up one of those guys, which makes it even tougher to do, obviously.
Yeah, they like optionality. I don't think they like to hit the kind of like blow it up button unless they have to. And if they still think there's something in Stanek because he was really good in the play, like he throws really hard. His stuff is great. He just doesn't know what to do with it at this point. But if maybe they don't want to move on from him yet, I think the only thing you could do, shy of like a Vanta Mael stint, which could get them in a lot of trouble if they start messing around with that, would be you call up one of the kids, you put Montas in the bullpen where he takes the Warren spot, and Montas is the like, okay, if McClain can only go 4 or 5 innings, he kind of mops it up there, see if he can fix things in that role, because their starters aren't going long. Like they do need somebody who can throw some innings, so maybe he could transition into that. And then after like a month or so, you know, you see how he does and then evaluate if he even makes the postseason roster. That's the only thing that seems like it makes sense, or he just stays in the rotation because they don't want to mess around with it.
Correct. Yes. That's really like the only path that we're looking at is that one spot that was previously occupied by Rico Garcia that Warren took, and that probably somebody else will take in a day's time. That's the one spot that you could play with. And they need to get to the point where they could afford to have someone like a Montas or insert your other starting pitcher option for that spot. And the problem with that is they needed to use that for mop-up purposes. And so like it makes it very tough because otherwise you're asking one of those big time relievers to pitch with like a 6-run lead or down 6 in a meaningless appearance. And you're essentially wasting them in that way. So it's tough. It's a tough situation, and it just goes back to shouldn't be this way. It should not be this way, and it is this way because they're not getting any length from their starting pitchers.
Yeah. Last question about the pitching, and then I'm going to talk about the offense a little bit. Is just from what you may have heard or just educated guessing, was there any starting pitcher that was not moved at the deadline that you felt like the Mets showed a lot of interest in? Maybe they had conversations about that you could see them resuming conversations about in the winter, circling back around to that?
Not that I heard that it got like really close at all. Like they probably checked in on those guys. I don't think some of this stuff may have been a little bit overblown as far as like a Mitch Keller, like I brought up earlier. I think that was pretty overblown in my view. I don't know if they were ever seriously involved there. But as far as like the other guys, they were interested in acquiring it, one of the top of the line guys. All those guys had issues though, even like Sandy Alcantara. Do you throw Zach Gallen in there? I don't know, but all those guys had problems. So those were your best options. I think that they checked in on guys like Alcantara, but the cost was really high, and the Marlins, to their credit, are winning games. And so I think that there was a real like, hey, we don't want to just blow this up right now because we have them for next year anyway. So I think that was more of like the Marlins putting the price tag up that nobody was touching it kind of thing for a reason. So, yeah, I think that it's possible that they pursue those lanes in the offseason for sure. You would just have to think about like how many spots they even have in their rotation for that. But when it comes to if you view that guy as number one, you make room for that guy, obviously. So, yeah, I think that there's definitely a path where they check back in on that in the offseason. But I'm not sure if it's something that they're able to pull off, or if enough guys are available where that's even very viable for them.
Yeah, definitely going to be interesting. To the offense, I specifically want to talk about the Juan Soto of it all. After a really good June, kind of seems like we're back in the same place we were in April and May. I was at the stadium on Saturday, but heard similar things on the TV all weekend. Of the boos have come back for the first time in a couple of months for him. A lot of just like uncomfortable chatter coming from the stands, and he's 8 for his last 56. That's a 143 batting average. And the big thing with him, and you know, I was talking about this at the game on Saturday, was it's the runners in scoring position thing continues to be a thing, not just for the entire team, but really like a huge anomaly for him specifically. He's hitting 185 with runners in scoring position this year. He hit 345 last year in those situations, and is his career. He's a 284 hitter with runners in scoring position. It just seems like, I know it is a very random stat year to year, sometimes month to month, but it has been the one thing, even when he had his hottest month in June, where he was maybe the best hitter in baseball that month, even in June, he was bad with runners in scoring position. It has been the one thing he has not been able to shake. From conversations with Juan, from Eric Chavez, Jeremy Barnes, you know, all the guys around the team, what do you think is going on with Soto specifically when it comes to these clutch situations?
Well, he gets pitched very tough in those situations. I'll give him that. Like, it's something where I've seen fans even complain about umpires' calls on him and it being sort of comical sometimes when it's something that's, it feels like every 50-50 goes the other way against him. And there are a lot of calls.
That one Padres game was.
Yeah, there's a lot of instances where the strike zone just loses the umpire, it feels like, when he's at the plate. I don't know. I've never seen a guy get called out on so many borderline pitches on the edges of the strike zone. But then again, I've never seen a batter who knows the strike zone as well as Juan Soto to take that many pitches in the first place,
right,
and be right about them. So I think it's a combination of that and that, in that case of where I'm talking about, where he's so good at understanding the zone, it almost works against him in some cases, where you're almost like, you just should have swung there because there's a chance he gets called out on it. He's not going to do that, though, because he's got to this point in his life,
right,
the way he is for a reason, clearly. So as far as – so that, I think just the way that he gets pitched is part of it. I'd have to dig into the numbers on that with guys on base and runners in scoring position in particular. But I'd assume that he gets pitched even tougher, and he's probably not getting as many pitches to hit. Some of it I really can't grasp because I don't think he's even hit a three-run home run yet. So it's been a very weird thing where even lately they've needed this guy to come through in those situations. They're in a spot where they need this guy to come through in a big spot, whether it's late in the game, middle, it doesn't matter. As long as he's getting the hit with guys on base. It's been strange. I can't really make too much sense of it, unfortunately. I wish I had a better answer for you, but it's just one of those things where I don't get it beyond the fact of him being pitched pretty tough in those situations. And even that, I'm sure there are instances where it's been pitches that are hittable pitches that just have not worked in his way. And maybe that's some luck, bad luck that he runs into. I don't know. I don't think that it has anything to do with, like, putting more pressure on himself, because I just feel like it's not like when you're Juan Soto, that pressure is going away. It doesn't really matter. If the score is 2-1 and you're up at the plate, you're Juan Soto, there's immense pressure on you in that situation, whether the bases are empty or full. So I don't think it's additional pressure. And this is also somebody who has handled pressure his entire life at a high level for a while now. So I don't think that there's that glaring reason to it. I just know that it has to change for the Mets, and I feel like it eventually will. It has to, and perhaps it does for these next 2 months.
It's been confounding, to say the least. There's so many times where I'm watching the games and Gary Cohen's like, man, this would be the moment for Soto that we've been waiting, and it just like never happens. It is very odd. And like, it's not to say he's like never had a big hit. You know, he hit a game winning home run in the seventh against the Giants last weekend. He's got that hit against the Orioles. Like, they have happened. It's just been very few and far between in those moments where you watched him on the Yankees or the Nationals. Like, it seemed like he always got that hit. And it just seems like that like signature Mets moment, so to speak, has eluded him. And it is really hard to figure out like why that is. And, you know, people will wonder, you know, is it the pressure? Cause it is a different pressure he's ever faced before. You know, he's been in two World Series at this point. He won one, been in the playoffs a lot. He came up as a teenager. He's faced pressure all the time, to your point, but you know, he never has made a $760 million before, the thing that he had been kind of working towards his entire playing career. And I'm not a psychiatrist. I can't tell you whether or not it is or isn't impacting him. It's kind of hard to figure out any real reason for it. So I think we're all searching for answers any way we can get them.
Yeah, totally. You know, I shouldn't even say that. I don't know either. Right. Like nobody's inside the man's head. It's just based on prior experience. I'd have a hard time thinking that he has allowed that to seep into such a specific instance almost every single time. I mean, there's also like runners in scoring position with in a blowout game. There's been instances where he has not come through. So I don't know if like is he coming up there every single time thinking about, I don't know, who knows.
Yeah.
But it does appear to be a separator in these games though for the Mets, where for the Yankees, for all their issues last year, whether it was fundamentals or whatever it was, they could bank on Juan Soto and Aaron Judge coming through. And they did it time and time again. And that was a separator for them in how they won games. In some of these Mets losses, that has not happened. And they would have been wins had that been the opposite, where Juan Soto didn't come through. Mm-hmm. Not to pin it all on him, but that's just the difference of the two teams, in my view, from like last year's Juan Soto and the Yankees and this year's Juan Soto and the Mets, where we have not seen him necessarily help them get through what would have otherwise been losses that turned out to wins. It's been, these were losses and they could have been wins. So that's been something that I've noticed when I compare the guy that he looked like when I was watching him on TV for the Yankees to what I'm seeing every day for the Mets.
Yeah. Friday night against the Giants, I think great example of that, you know, in a 10th inning, I think he comes up with two on and one out and he pops up or strikes out or so, like, no doubt in my mind, if he was on the Yankees, that's like a 3-run walk-off home run. Even in the 8th inning of that game when they came back, you know, he did hit, he got credit for an RBI single, but if that ball doesn't take a funky bounce, that's an inning-ending double play. They probably lose 3-1, not even going into extra innings. So it's been very strange. I don't know how often you guys get to talk to the positional coaches, but you know, you ever talk to like Chavez or Barnes about this specifically in regards to Soto? Like, what did they have to say about this thing?
Yeah, not a whole lot that I haven't said just now. It's one of those things where they haven't really chalked it up to any specific reason as to. And that goes for even like the runners in scoring position for the team-wide struggles on that. I think when you're talking team-wide and not just a specific guy, sometimes you get some better answers with that just because it's not necessarily like a collective approach to like, hey, we're all going to put some pressure on ourselves, but you could clearly see it being a team thing where after a while, and I think it's just human nature, if you struggle day after day in this particular area, it is only human nature for that to get into your head a bit. And I think collectively, in some cases, at some points of the season, that probably happened where it's like, okay, this is happening again. Like, what's going on? Or this is going to be the time it changes and it just doesn't change. They've talked about it intensely all the time. I feel like every time I check in on it, like it has not been something that has consistently changed for the better. It's been here and there. I think it's been better a little bit lately in some instances, but it's not something yet that you feel has turned in a way that, okay, the Mets are beyond that. It's been a season long.
Yeah, definitely not in a meaningful way. I think Carlos Mendoza the other day mentioned about the hittable fastballs thing. Like, they're just missing, like, how many times I've seen like a 92 mile an hour fastball, like, in the middle of the plate get like popped back or whatever. It seems like that's happened a lot. Maybe they are putting a lot of pressure on themselves. I was looking at the numbers the other day, and much to my surprise, they actually hit really well with runners in scoring position in July. I think it was 260, something like that. And yet by OPS plus, it was actually far and away their worst offensive month of the season. So I think that's even part of it. Of they actually finally kind of started to hit with runners in scoring position, but it wasn't in a meaningful way. So no one even noticed. And that was mostly because the top four guys really struggled, especially that like back half of July. And it was mostly the bottom of the order was getting things done and kind of carried them for most of that 7-game winning streak. You'd mentioned at the top of the episode, it's almost like a little bit of an anomaly. I think it was because of the way that they were doing it. So you hope that it's getting better. They did have a breakout on Saturday after a really frustrating night on Friday. Today, you know, it's hard to blame today on the offense. They gave up 12 runs and were basically out of the game from the get-go. But, you know, sometimes you'd like to see at least like claw back a little bit, have a fake comeback going instead of like it's the seventh inning and you have two hits and one home run and a single or something. So, you know, you hope it gets better, and it's going to need to be there. I mean, they're going to have to improve on everything to what we've been talking about. Cool. Before we wrap it up, we always designate a Met of the Week on every one of our shows. It's the player or person who either positively or negatively you think was the biggest story for the Mets the past week. We normally try to make this a positive one. I would say that's kind of hard to do this week. So who do you feel like was the big story for the Mets this past week?
For me, it probably is Frankie Montas, just because of the amount of discussion on starting pitching, and then he is the guy who ends up just having a couple of duds sprinkled in that conversation in the bookends of the trade deadline conversation. Yep. And so it's hard to not zero in on him as the example of this. Just because, I don't know about you, but I feel pretty okay about Kodai Senga's chances of looking like he did before the injury, where he's getting into the fifth, sixth inning and pitching effectively. Okay, sure. Sean Manaea has taken a step forward. It looks like he's on the verge, or he's like right there to getting to be able to go 90-plus pitches, trip toward 100 pitches, just be a regular guy at this point. And then, like we've talked about with David Peterson, sure, Clay Holmes will always be a discussion, but I just feel like with Frankie Montas and just how bad things were on Sunday, it's hard not to go with him because he's the guy that just also hasn't done it. Like we've seen Clay Holmes be pretty effective at times this season, or at least early on in the year, and you're almost giving him a mulligan of, hey, this is his first time even starting games. With Frankie Montas, you have the whole conversation about they gave this guy a 2-year deal, they didn't get somebody at the trade deadline. They could bring up the prospects. So it's hard for him not to be the guy this week that I think is central to the main discussion point.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, Clay Holmes is probably happy right now just because the heat's kind of off of him. You know, all the talk for like the last few weeks was you got to move Clay Holmes to the bullpen. It's not working. And he has definitely struggled the last 6-7 times out there. But yeah, I mean, Montas has been basically unpitchable the last two times, small sample size, but his ERA for the past week was almost 13. He gave up 5 runs against the Padres, which really started this new skid, and then 7 runs on Sunday. So really tough. For me, I'll go with David Stearns, and we don't know if that's positive or negative. It's just, he's the architect of the team. He added to the team, I think, more aggressively in ways that I didn't expect. And then again, not so aggressively in other areas. A lot of that was the market that dictated it. And we'll see at the end of the year if he did enough or not. You know, sometimes you don't always know right away. You know, the Yankees the other day thought they had this great trade deadline, and they had one of the most uniquely blow-up kind of meltdown games from every single one of those guys. I'm sure at the end of the year, those guys will all be fine and be contributors. So all to say, we don't really know. It's been a couple days, and it's really going to take the rest of the year for us to see. Looking ahead, Mets have 3 games at home against the Cleveland Guardians, who've been playing better recently, though they did trade off a couple guys. They do not have their closer because of a gambling scandal. And then they go to Milwaukee for three games, which should be pretty big series for them. They did win two of three from the Brewers last time, but the Brewers have basically been the best team in baseball since then. So should be a very interesting week. Hopefully the team can start to get it together and make some inroads here. And we'll see if they, you know, bring up one of these kids or not. Will, before we jump off, where can the people find you?
Well, thanks for having me, Rich. I'm on X and Blue Sky, just at Will Salmon, and on theathletic.com. Tim Britton and I do our best to give coverage every single day on the Mets as the Athletic speed writers. And we appreciate everybody who check out our work on the website.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on, Will, and everybody else. We will be back next week. Let's go, Mets.
Thanks for listening to this unlocked episode of the Just Mets podcast.
If you liked what you heard and want access to full weekly episodes and additional bonus content, you can become a supporter of Just Mets on patreon.com/justmets or on justmets.net.